You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast, Ancient Asides edition. I think we're on number 9 of these so far, although it has been forever since we've recorded one. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an associate professor of political science here at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Jordan Poss, instructor of history at Piedmont Technical College in Greenwood, South Carolina. Jordan, how are things going in the deeper South?
Good. Like we were talking about before we started recording, it's hot and humid, and I think both of us have been sick recently.
Yeah, you can probably tell my voice is a little scratchier than normal, and hopefully it'll make it through this podcast. But you know, these are always short, right? So it should be fine.
Yeah, I've got some kind of weird summer allergy thing, and I have to blame that on South Carolina, like I always do. I never had allergies till I moved here.
Yeah, when I lived in Montana, I'd have allergies like when I was, you know, shoveling grain or driving a tractor. But other than that, it was usually fine. And then I moved to D.C. and I have allergies for like a month in the spring and a month in the fall. And then I moved to Southwest Missouri, and it's literally every day all year, like 365 days a year.
Yeah.
And it's not just me. Like, it's I meet, you know, people who grew up here are like, yeah, it's terrible.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the Greenville, not Greenwood, but Greenville area has like the highest pollen count in the country or something.
That's crazy.
I mean, when it rains in the spring, like the roads are just caked in this like yellow sludge. It's disgusting.
Yeah, so I'm not exactly a Yankee, but when it comes to the climate, I'm definitely a northerner at heart.
Like, well, I'm a hillbilly. I want to be up and out of some of the humidity and stuff, you know, back in my mountains. So,
well, you're fake mountains. I mean, come on. I've seen the Appalachians.
Boo.
I say that as someone who now lives in the Ozarks, and people are like, "What do you think of the mountains?" I'm like, "Where?"
Yeah.
I haven't seen them yet.
Well, I've only been into your area just once. We landed in, my dad was flying, and we landed in Branson and had lunch at some little college nearby. And yeah, I only realized after we left again, I was like, oh, we were supposed to be in like the Ozark Mountains. But
yeah,
anyway.
Branson is, we could talk about that. If you've been to Branson, you have seen like the one of the major things to see in the area. But if you didn't do any of the shows, then you have to go back.
No, okay. Well, we just landed 8 and kept flying, so.
Sure.
I gather it's like the Gatlinburg of the Midwest.
Yeah, so you missed your chance to see Yakov Smirnov. He just retired to be a family counselor, of all things.
Well, in Soviet Russia, your career retires you. I just botched that, man.
We actually saw an interview the local news did with him. He was like, yeah, the Soviet Union collapsed, and that was kind of the end of all of my comedy. So I had to find a place where they didn't know the Soviet Union collapsed. So I went to Branson.
That's great.
Well, speaking of things that have collapsed,
yes.
We should move back into Rome to deal with sort of where we've been. And I don't know when this episode will drop relative to when the other episodes have dropped. But we've talked about Rome up through the end of the 3rd century, or up through the towards the end of the 3rd century, through the crisis that sweeps across Rome with civil wars and emperors being murdered and basically 50 years of chaos. And then we sort of reset and talked about the history of Christianity and some of the issues and events that Christians are dealing with, again, up until roughly this time, especially focusing on some of the major figures and some of the major heresies. And we talked a little bit about how there's sort of a dualism in approaching that ancient history, right? You're either a Roman historian or you're a church historian, and there aren't many people who bring those two fields together. So I think you talked about when you teach Western Civ, right? You basically have to teach that time period twice.
Yeah. And you're jumping back and forth, and I mean, it gets really confusing for the students, and again, I still haven't found a really great way to resolve that.
Right, and so that dualism is in some ways resolved in the guy we're going to be talking about today, in Diocletian, sort of resolved. He is where the two lecture tracks in that intro level class get brought back together. He's the point where Christianity and the Roman Empire start to blend or start to collide or whatever way you want to say that, which raises the question of who is Diocletian. Jordan, I've given you a few of these kinds of questions in the past, so I'm going to give you another one. Tell us everything we know about Diocletian's childhood.
No. we know almost nothing. He's got a really mysterious origin. He's apparently Dalmatian, and that I don't mean that by that he's spotty. He is from roughly modern day Yugoslavia, or the former Yugoslavia. I'm dating myself a little bit. He even retires there. We'll talk about his retirement later, I figure. But comes from Dalmatia, retires to Dalmatia. Beyond that, we don't really know much. There are some hostile sources that suggest he was the child of a slave, but that seems really, really unlikely. Slightly more likely, possibly the child of a freedman, but again, there's nothing to corroborate these stories really beyond a couple of very hostile sources, and I think they're fairly late. I'm not exactly sure. Beyond that, the first real good evidence we get of him is of him as a general in the army. If we're wanting to be able to psychoanalyze or kind of like construct a really keen understanding of what makes the guy tick the way you could with like a Caesar or a Cicero, you're just going to be out of luck. There's a lot of guesswork that has to happen with what's going on. Well, I just tapped my head up here.
Well, I want to ask a question. I want to ask you a question, and then I want to come back to the question at the end after we've talked about him. Do you think Diocletian is a good guy or a bad guy?
Oh, he's such, a long time ago, I would have just said straight up bad guy, but that was strictly because he persecuted Christians. He's a real mixed bag, like a really mixed bag. Obviously, the persecution is nasty, and that's a big negative mark, but he does save the empire.
Right.
But he does set up the empire to be something even possibly worse than it was before, with the kind of, and we'll talk about this, but, kind of bringing in all these sort of, understand I'm not, using this prescriptively, but these kind of oriental trappings of kind of, this supreme potentate with all the pomp and the ceremony and the circumstance and that kind of thing. So it's for me, it's very hard to draw a definitive good versus bad line. I mean, I'm going to say, as a Christian, he's a bad guy. But if I'm a Roman at the time and I care about preserving the empire and maintaining peace and stability and order, he's a good guy because he actually manages to, wrench some kind of real stability out of this nasty, nasty 70 years of chaos and sets it up to last probably longer than it would have otherwise.
Yeah, and certainly if you count the Byzantine Empire, right? I mean, that's all right. Diocletian.
Yeah.
So it lasts in the West for another 150 years after him, and in the East for, another 1,100 years?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Roman Empire, or something calling itself the Roman Empire, doesn't fall until the 1450s. So, I mean, he's one of a number of people that we've already talked about. I think we talked about, like, Vespasian before.
Right.
And, of course, Augustus himself, who gets the project going in the first place after all that civil war. Like, dealing with, as a conservative, dealing with the materials that you've actually got instead of some sort of ideal, Diocletian does a pretty good job. But, again, what he creates is significantly different from, the little small town in Rome with all the little republican virtues that we've talked about before. It's something much more, I don't even know what the right word is here. I'm on allergy meds, just FYI.
So this should be fun, right?
Oh, yeah. If I start talking about, mythical creatures or something, just pause for a minute. What he creates is, he preserves the empire, but radically changes it as well. And we can get to this in more detail, but something I was reflecting on, not to import modern political categories into it, again, because that's always questionable. But, as a conservative, I care a lot about, what you could call federalism or localism. There's a certain amount of that the Roman Empire has always practiced, which is one reason it's so flexible and it lasts as long as it does. Diocletian kind of helps further that by splitting the empire so that there's, not just one guy calling the shots for this whole, tricontinental empire. But at the same time, He is also gigantically increasing the size of what we would call, you know, big government or the bureaucracy, right, which is going to further weigh down and lock into place ordinary people. So, you know, the direct link between some of Diocletian's reforms and what we could call feudalism in the Middle Ages is tenuous, but I think it's there. Because he's, you know, as part of his reforms, in order to I can't remember if it was Goldsworthy or Michael Grant actually used the word extort. In order to extort taxes from the countryside, he's got to, like, lock people down because they keep trying to weasel out from under the heel of government. So, again, he's preserving, but at the same time doing it in sometimes negative ways. Even as I'm rambling here, I'm vacillating back and forth between the good guy and the bad guy line. What would you say?
Yeah, I think I'm still largely where you're at, but the more I read about him and the more I read about Constantine, the more I kind of shift all of the good stuff towards Constantine, just because, as we'll talk about, Diocletian's reforms don't really work.
Yeah, right? not in the long run.
The goal is to keep civil wars from happening, and by the end of his life, civil wars are happening again, and right, and they're happening specifically because of the reforms he made.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right. He starts this system that lasts, you know, for 150 years in the life of the Roman Empire in the West, and then leads into feudalism. So in that sense, he gets credit for it, but he also doesn't work the way he wants it to, and maybe it doesn't work at all. Which means if he's persecuting Christians, so from the Christian point of view, he's bad, and his political stuff isn't working. I don't know. I have sort of mixed thoughts. But maybe we should dive into him rather than discuss him before we discuss.
Let everybody know what it is we're referring to.
So Diocletian, like you said, the first time we meet him for sure in history, he's a cavalry commander under the Emperor Carus. Carus had ruled for about a year, kind of 282 to 283. From what we know about him, he was actually a decent emperor. The empire seems to have been on the mend from its 50-year stretch of troubles. You know, again, our sources aren't that great, but it looks like things are getting better. We do know that Carus had enough power and control, and that the empire was stable enough that he could mount an invasion of Persia that succeeds in burning the Persian capital. Just like whenever America goes to war, we invade Canada. The Roman thing was to invade Persia, and the sign of a really successful campaign was to burn the Persian capital down,
right?
Which they managed to do.
Is that Ctesiphon?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
I'm glad you said it because I never noticed. Yeah. There's all those consonants in a row.
Yeah, I'm not sure I said it correctly. I just decide. Well, you know, most of these ancient languages are phonetic, so I'm going to pronounce every letter somehow.
Right.
Yeah.
So they torched that. His two sons, Numerian and Carinus, return to the Roman Empire, divide up the empire between themselves. When Carus dies under while in Persia under some I don't remember the circumstances. Do you remember those off the top of your head?
No, and I'm constantly, you know, it seems like every time the Romans invade Persia, half the time they do something good, half the time they pull a Crassus, you know.
Right.
And I can't keep him straight with Julian in the next generation or so, because you know, Julian dies under very similar circumstances.
Right, right. Although this death, there was someone clearly in charge. I don't remember if it was murder or not. Carinus returns to the west. Son of Carus returns to the west, takes command. Numerian takes command of the east. The next year, Numerian dies. This time of mysterious causes, but mysterious in that we don't know who killed him. Not mysterious in that we don't know if it was murder or not. The soldiers then declare Diocletian to be his replacement. Carinus was not okay with this. He marches eastward and fights Diocletian's army at the Battle of the Margus River in 285. Our sources are so bad here, we don't even know who won this battle. we don't know which side won. One story that happens to be my favorite of them says that Carinus defeats Diocletian, but is murdered by one of his own officers whose wife he had seduced. So now both the sons of Carus are dead. Diocletian is the sole emperor. He then goes to work stabilizing the borders of the empire, which had really been not so much neglected during the crisis of the third century as only managed under emergency circumstances. So someone would invade, and then some regional emperor would have to go and fight off the barbarians. Well, now Diocletian goes about stabilizing them. To help him with this, he goes back to sort of an older custom of making a co-emperor. So Marcus Aurelius, right, had appointed a co-emperor. Diocletian elevates a fellow commander named Maximian. Diocletian says this is such a good idea and it's so administratively useful. He makes it the cornerstone of his constitutional reforms, which we'll talk about in a minute. So Diocletian and Maximian look back at the... Am I saying that name right?
Maximian. Yeah, I mean, it's actually like Maximianus or something like that, Maximian's... That's the only way I've ever heard it.
Right, and listeners, I apologize because there's going to be like 10 people with that kind of name very shortly. So Diocletian and Maximian look back at the last 50 years and say, you know, this was awful. We want to make sure it never happens again. Right, so they set about reforming government, and they set about reforming the culture, which is where they come into a conflict with Christianity. Their argument is that the third century crisis, although of course they don't call it the third century crisis, wouldn't have happened if the Roman people were good, virtuous Romans. The problem was that they had fallen into moral decay and abandoned the worship of the traditional gods. At least that's the theory. So we're going to get back to being good traditional Romans. We're going to make Rome great again. And we're going to do that by taking all of the Romans along with us to things like attendance at public worship services. That's now mandatory in the Roman Empire. All alternative religions are banned, including the Manichaeans. That was seen as sort of a Persian religion anyway, and Christianity. So the idea is we're going to have a culture that is unified around these sort of traditionalist principles. Anything to add to that, Jordan?
No, I think that summarizes the situation pretty nicely.
Yeah, so that's culturally. I guess we should finish talking about that, the cultural side of things. So culturally, there's sort of a catalog that a process that this persecution goes through, that Eusebius recounts in, it's like book 8 or book 9 of the church history.
Yeah, I was just reading it last night. I think it's 9. Anyway, that's, you know, for anybody who's checking our footnotes.
Right, so it starts very small, right, with the idea that you just have to go down and make a sacrifice, and if you do that, you're good, right? Whatever, you can be a Christian, you can be a Manichaean, you can be any of those things, that's fine. Just go make your sacrifice. You get a little certificate that says you've made the sacrifice, and you're good to go, which puts Christians in sort of a bind. Because of the crisis of the third century, Christians had largely been without persecution for half a century, with, you know, sporadic and regional persecutions here and there. But for the most part, they've been left alone. So when all of a sudden the government is now organized and stable and knocking on your door, they're really not prepared for it. They're not sort of psychologically or you know, even physically prepared for it. Many, many, many Christians apostatize. Many of them go and make the sacrifices, which once it's now legal to be a Christian without doing that again, that raises the question of, well, what do we do with these people who made these sacrifices and now want back in? Do we allow them back in or not? Diocletian realizes that there are many Christians who are not giving into this. So he amps up the persecution by demanding that Christians turn over their Bibles. You know, this is a religion of the book. Well, let's get rid of the books, which again creates a sort of crisis of conscience for Christians. Do we turn the books in? Do we turn the Bibles in or not? Some Christians do. Again, when you turn in the Bible, you get a little certificate saying you've turned it in from the local government. So you can turn in the Bible. These guys presumably say, look, you know, our religion is based on the Word of God, but our faith is not tied to it. We can turn them over and still be Christians. these guys become known as traditores, the handers over, that'll cause all sorts of problems down the road in the church. There are Christians who refuse to hand over their Bibles. In North Africa, the leader of these Christians who refuses to hand over the Bibles, their Bibles, is a man named Donatus. Again, that's setting up a future tension in the church. Mm-hmm. You also have some people who try to straddle the line. You have You have Christians who bribe local officials to get the little certificates from them, so that they don't have to turn over their Bibles, but they have the certificate, so they're not persecuted. Same thing with making the sacrifice. You can hand over the you can buy the certificate and not make the sacrifice, which raises sort of ethical questions, but right. At least you're not sacrificing to pagan gods. And then there are occasionally, in terms of handing over scriptures, often Roman soldiers who would be sent out to collect these Bibles are illiterate. So you'd have Christian bishops who would hand over, copies of Plato or copies of Josephus or whatever, and, weep and moan and, oh, no, not our Bible, don't take it from us. And then they get the certificate and still have their Bibles, which, again, raises sort of ethical questions. Is that, mm-hmm. is that ethically okay for a Christian?
This brings something really dumb to mind, but my mom, like a lot of Southern women, watched Fried Green Tomatoes just basically on a continuous loop a lot when I was a kid. There's a minor plot point where the local preacher, who's a relatively minor character, perjures himself during a murder trial in order to defend an innocent person. And it is pointed out after the murder trial that he had brought, quote-unquote, his own Bible to swear on when he's sworn in as a witness. Somebody says, well, if you looked closely, you'd have seen it was actually a copy of Moby Dick. Same basic thing. Silly version there, but I mean, if you imagine that you're kind of at a life and death struggle, something like that might become more tempting.
If you'd asked me, can you relate Fried Green Tomatoes to ancient Rome? I would have said no, but there you go.
This is allergy meds. Here we go.
So when seizing the Bibles, doesn't eliminate Christianity, finally persecution begins. And again, there's this sort of beginning in the center and moving outward towards the provinces. Persecution begins with the purging, and this is all in Eusebius, the purging of government officials who are Christians, and then on to sort of prominent aristocrats and regional officials who are Christians, and then finally going after the rank and file. I don't remember if this is the only sort of truly empire-wide persecution, but it is certainly the biggest persecution in ancient Rome.
Right.
Not the biggest persecution in the ancient world, even, but in ancient Rome.
Right, and I don't think it's the only empire-wide one, but it is certainly the most systematic and thorough. It is remembered from that point forward as the great persecution.
Right, and it very nearly works. Again, mm-hmm. Christianity had gotten complacent. It had gotten very lax in its sort of not being persecuted and right. being sort of unofficially tolerated by emperors who were too busy fighting each other
right.
or barbarians to bother with the Christians. When this sort of real persecution comes along, it catches them off guard, and there's a reason that the Donatists have such powerful moral force down the road.
I mean,
they're really the ones who stick to their guns. Mm-hmm.
Eusebius, to your point, Eusebius even begins his description of the reign of Diocletian by saying, we were basically left alone. We even had some friendly emperors, and so we got fat and happy, and we kind of earned this sort of purging in a way.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll get to Donatus this episode or not. I think there is something to be said for that approach, even though they go too far. Even though they become schismatic to the point of overwhelming the gospel with their division,
right.
I mean they're not theologically different from the Orthodox, right? They're not theologically different from the Catholics, small c Catholics. Mm.
Not superficially anyway, but the thing about the Donatist heresy, it's not like. It's not like, the Ebionites or the Marcionites or the Arians right. or especially the Gnostics. I mean, it's maybe even a little bit more insidious, which is that, and we can talk about the Donatists in more detail later, but I mean, the assumptions they bring to their schism are things that will eventually, as you work through the logic of it, undermine the gospel because, they're emphasizing the spiritual state of people involved in religious ritual rather than the grace of God actually working through ritual. So we can get to that later.
Yeah, well, I'll give my defense of the Donatists later. I think they're both wrong when it comes to how far they are willing to go in sort of going after the other side. But yeah, so the persecution again is huge, all as part of Diocletian's attempt to unify the empire culturally, and even out this sort of cultural conservative, like you said at the beginning, he's adding all sorts of cultural, I don't know what you call them, I guess cultural bling to the office of the emperor. He's orientalizing is a good word in the ancient sense of that.
Right.
In the sense that the idea is that the emperor is not just more important politically. He is somehow apart from and above everyone else.
Right.
So we've seen some of that earlier in the empire, almost exclusively from the crazy emperors.
Yes.
Right. So he starts to add in the trappings of the Oriental monarch: funny robes, silly hats, mm-hmm. Gold chains and rings, and
jewel encrusted shoes. Everything purple. Yeah.
And he also adds in a long process and lots of formalities that have to be gone through in order to even approach the emperor. Mm-hmm. So I always forget if this is Trajan or Hadrian, right, who was out riding his horse one day, and some old woman starts yelling at him. He's like, hey, I need justice. And he's like, I don't have time. And she's like, don't be emperor if you don't have time. Well, you can't do that with Diocletian.
Right. Even Augustus would just go walking around town, you know, like, The distance we've come from the Augustus and the Trajan model is really striking when you get to Diocletian, who formalizes so much of this kind of, you know, again, pomp.
Yeah. So Diocletian again adds all of this stuff in, and this starts sort of a snowball effect, right? Over the next few centuries, especially in the city of Constantinople, the emperor just gets more and more opulent until mm-hmm. finally you have literally an emperor who would be lowered from the ceiling in a throne when people would come into the room. That's down the road. Diocletian, I don't think Diocletian starts that, but he starts the idea of that.
Right. He creates the circumstances in which that becomes possible.
Right.
Right. Right.
Anything else on his cultural reforms? Otherwise, we should move on to his politics.
Nothing I can think of off the top of my head. I mean, the motivation for the persecutions is pretty standard. Again, what distinguishes it is simply the more widespread and systematic aspect of it, and that's very closely tied to the political reforms that he makes. Because what he's trying to do, in addition, and I think what sets him apart from the crazy emperors, like you talked about, is not only is he promoting all of this pomp and stuff. Because, I mean, you know, even in the founding of the United States, guys like John Adams thought, you know, a little bit of pomp would help people respect this new presidential office, right? And, you know,
right.
He was the one who wanted to call George Washington, like, His Excellency or whatever, or his supreme something, you know.
Right.
I don't think Diocletian is entirely hung up on himself and his own power, because he does retire eventually. But he's trying to create an environment in which a very powerful emperor can exercise more and more and more direct control in a way that would have driven, like, you know, a Cincinnatus or a Brutus crazy.
Right.
But is becoming more and more necessary politically because of the, again, kind of increasing size and just bloated mass of the empire.
Which is interesting, because it's not actually any bigger than it was under Augustus.
Right, geographically, right. The army, you know, when you've got multiple armies constantly competing with each other, and, you know, a greater and greater tax burden because of all the building projects and things like that, and we can talk more about kind of his division, you know, chopping up the empire. There was some other aspect of that I wanted to talk about as well. You know,
well, there's the
oh, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Or say, yeah, there's the practical military side, right? Certainly there is more pressure on the borders from barbarians now than there had been under Augustus.
Right.
So barbarian invasions on each border, the one in Germany and the one in the Middle East, and the emperor can't be both places dealing with him at the same time.
Right.
So just practically, he says, look, the Diocletian, you know, argues, and he's emperor, so he wins the argument, that the empire is just too big to be administered by one person, mm-hmm. Especially militarily.
Right. Oh, and the administration is what I was thinking of a second ago. I mean, I'm not exactly sure where Goldsworthy is getting these numbers, but in his book, The End of Rome, he talks about, you know, and he emphasizes this a little bit as well in his biographies of A Biography of Augustus and that book Pax Romana that I reviewed last year, that the bureaucracy used to administer the entire empire is actually relatively small and trim for a long time, but it's increased, like, by the time of Diocletian, it's increased significantly, and he quadruples the size of it. So, I mean, it's by the time he's done, you know, there's 30 or 40,000 bureaucrats empire-wide, and, you know, there's now four emperors, each of whom requires their own staff, their own, you know, administrative apparatus, and all these other kinds of things, you know, tax collectors and assessors and things like that. City collectors.
Most important job.
Clearly. Exactly. And so, I mean, that's, you know, when we talk about the increasing size of the government rather than geographically, it is in that, specifically in those bureaucratic kind of middle management layers that have always been very trim but are now thickening up. To speak from my own experience, the emperor is getting the empire is getting a dad bod.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, to use the anachronistic term that you used earlier, the earlier empire relied pretty heavily on sort of federal principles.
Yes.
Right? They would just tell a province or tell a region, you owe X much in taxes and X many, you know, levies of men.
Mm-hmm.
You guys figure out how to do it and make sure you do it. And maybe we'll have a governor to supervise you.
Right.
Now that those, because of this 50 years of civil war and because of some of the stuff that had gone on earlier in the empire,
mm-hmm.
Those local governments are either rebellious or defunct.
Right.
So you have to have the feds come in and take over, but
right.
An administrative bloat, right? I mean,
right. And it's, you know, it's kind of like that trend that, I mean, we're both conservatives that we're always warning against, where if you empower the top level, the middle layers get eaten out until they don't exist anymore. And they're,
right.
You know, Diocletian's trying to attack into the ambush there. He's trying to, you know, it's like, okay, this is the situation we've got. We've just got to deal with it somehow. And not all of it is Diocletian. I mean, you know,
sure.
it was Caracalla who issued universal citizenship, right, for anybody in the empire. I mean, that's got ripple effects, you know, because suddenly everybody is subject to the same law code, which must be enforced universally across this vast and very diverse empire. I mean, it's again, the parallels between them and us are dangerous, but there are some where, as you and Ed very often debate, why should somebody from, you know, Georgia or Missouri or Montana or Tennessee, wherever, abide by a California law? But that is increasingly the model in our, you know, theoretically federal republic, and it's what Diocletian's basically got going on with, you know, universal enforcement of a single law code, which is a first for the Romans.
Right. At least at that scale.
Right.
Those are all sort of the practical side. There's also a theoretical component to this argument of division. One major cause of the, you know, 50 years of civil war and the crisis of the third century is that there is one job that everyone wants.
Right.
Right. So under the Republic, you have lots and lots of offices, you know, two consuls and two censors and the whole Senate that you could be a part of, lots of opportunities for advancement and success. So Diocletian argues you'll never have peace as long as there's more than one person who wants that one job.
Right.
And the lesson of the third century crisis had been that if you just want it bad enough, you can at least get it temporarily.
Yeah.
to solve this problem, Diocletian again brands himself as a conservative. Says we need to get back to the best principles of the Roman Republic and the earlier empire, and reestablish the doctrine of the principle of collegiality. So he takes this principle of collegiality, applies it to the empire. He cuts the empire into four dioceses. Does he actually name them after himself, or have we just done that retroactively?
You know, I'm not actually sure. That's a really good question.
Yeah, I don't know. So, Diocletian diocese.
Yeah, I would. Oh, you mean the word diocese?
Yeah.
That's a really great question. I'm going to the etymology dictionary.
I sprung that on you.
No, you're good. What I was struck by, of course, is that, you know, these are administrative units that are eventually used to help structure the church, and then
right.
The church is the only part of that actually left. So gradually, you know, it starts as a government reform, becomes a structural principle of the church, and that's the only vestige of Diocletian's system that's left. Diocese from Greek dioikesis, government, administration, province. Originally, economy, housekeeping from, die, and then oikein, right, for like economy, oikos, home, like housekeeping. Oh, dia, thoroughly. So dia and oikos, thoroughly, housekeeping, administration, government. That's the evolution that goes through.
So it's just sort of a coincidence of his name and the...
Yeah, because his name originally is Diocles, but not actually sure what that means. But yeah, I would never would have made that connection.
Well, yeah, that's benefits of not knowing Greek very well, as you get to put things together that don't go well together.
Yeah, I lean very heavily on the online etymology dictionary just because I'm a word nerd, and it does help kind of... definitely gives you an idea of what they have in mind when they start using words like that.
Sure. Well, these four dioceses, he then creates four offices to govern them. The two chief offices are the offices of the Augusti. There's one Augustus in two of these dioceses. So one Augustus is in charge of the western half of the empire. The other is in charge of the eastern half. To assist them, these two Augusti are each in the border diocese, so the ones that are most likely to be invaded by, mm-hmm. by barbarians or by Persians. The smaller, safer parts of each half of each diocese are carved out and given to the other offices, the Caesares. Each Caesar is then to keep order in the quiet parts of the empire, so each Augustus can then focus on defending the borders and the places where the empire is more threatened. And the idea is that the Caesar is a junior colleague, sort of a colleague in training, waiting to step into the boots of the Augustus when the Augustus dies or retires. The whole system is called the Tetrarchy, so four officials in charge of the empire. Earlier, they had the Diarchy, with theoretically the emperor and the Senate ruling together. Now there are four points of power in the empire, none of which is the Senate. The Senate is still around. It's still meeting. Nobody cares about it anymore.
Right.
In fact, there's going to very shortly be a rival Senate set up in Constantinople, which is not Constantinople yet.
Right.
But, excuse me. The Augusti have sort of the final say, but any declaration of law that any of these officials make is released with the name of all four officers on it. Again, collegiality is at work here. Anything to add on the structure? Otherwise, I'll talk about the substance of some of these.
I would just point out as well that I think there's eventually even further subdivision of the dioceses into like
yes.
12 or 13. But there's a greater and greater partitioning of the empire. So large provinces like Gaul that used to be kind of just a chunk or kind of a large chunk are further and further subdivided. And part of that is just to exercise tighter control over the countryside. Especially a large, fairly well-to-do, stable province like Gaul or Britannia is going to be a breeding ground for rivals for the purple. So
yes, so
split it up, you know, keep authority. I mean, this is a wise, it's paranoid, but it's also wise, you know, further subdivide things so that things are kept more local, that the resources at the beck and call of a powerful military commander are relatively limited. But that also assists Diocletian in his project to, again, kind of get into the pocketbooks of everybody in the empire, because then you have, again, through that expanded bureaucracy, more and more narrowly focused, you know, tax collectors, assessors, things like that.
Yeah, I don't know how deep into the administrative state we want to go, into the deep state here we want to go. He basically further, so there's the two Augusti, two Caesars. He then further divides the empire into two separate administrative units. There's the military administration and the civil administration. The military administration is governed under the Augustus and the Caesar by this school of seven generals, sort of the equivalent of our joint chiefs, kind of in charge of overall military operations. And then each diocese is further divided by military unit. There'll be a master of soldiers between 5 and 10 of those, depending on the year and the region they're in charge of. And then under those territorial commanders in charge of specific places, the titles for these territorial commanders are actually the ones that stick around, dukes and comes.
Right.
Right. So duke and count. But then there's the civil administration side where again, the empire is yet again subdivided into prefectures. So Praetorian prefects govern prefectures. I forget how many of these there are. I think there's I think there's like 4 in each diocese or something like that. And then each prefecture is further subdivided into provinces, which they did, you know, have as many of those as they had based on their size and population and so on. So yeah, and there's not necessarily an overlap between the military units and the civil units. So you might have one civil unit with several military units, or one military unit with several civil units, just based on the needs of the time and place.
Right.
So it's super complicated. I mean, it basically what Diocletian is doing would be sort of the equivalent of taking a map of the country today, wiping out all of the state and county lines, and then drawing according to, you know, latitude and longitude or you know, population centers or whatever, new districts over the country, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, the premise behind Hunger Games, but that's not what Diocletian does with it. a couple of other changes that he adds in his reforms. These are the intent is that this is going to settle the Roman Constitution once and for all. These 4 top offices, Augusti and Caesar's, are functionally turned into kings. So up until this point, the Senate was at least nominally allowed to vote on laws and magistrates. That's no longer the case. Whatever had been left of the old Republican magistracies disappears. The government is now entirely in the hands of imperial officials, which is why there's this emphasis on division into military and civil administration of the empire. The second major thing he does, he declares an order of succession based on the Tetrarchy. So when an Augustus dies or retires, the Caesar who serves under him will become the new Augustus. The new Augustus then will appoint a new Caesar. If something happens in one half of the empire and both the Augustus and the Caesar are killed in battle or something like that, you've got the other two to fall back on. So in theory, this should be a very smoothly turning wheel. Mm-hmm. And it is, as long as Diocletian is on the scene keeping an eye on things.
Right.
So yeah, those are his political reforms, his cultural reforms. Jordan, anything to add into any of that?
I'm wading into dangerous waters here because I'm not an economic historian and I have a terrible head for math, but he does do a lot to reform coinage. That's a real serious problem, is inflation and debased currency. He tries to purify the currency to a certain extent, issues, you know, kind of new multi-denarius coins and things like that to kind of help stabilize the economy a little bit, and even, I believe, it passes regulations fixing certain set prices for certain commodities and things, you know, grain, cattle, you know, basic day-to-day trade stuff, so that if you didn't have actual specie, you could trade fairly under, you know, government auspices. Those don't appear to have worked. There are, you know, that we have very limited understanding of those, because a lot of those edicts survive only partially or in amended copies, and they are also criticized by other sources for not right. working as. So, I mean, imagine, you know, these are sort of the Roosevelt administration does similar things during the New Deal, right? Setting particular wages, setting right. particular prices, stuff, you know, like the NRA, the Blue Eagle NRA, not the Rifle Association. You know, the NRA, which is eventually judged unconstitutional, tries to do very similar kind of price fixing and wage settlement things. That is unsuccessful largely as well. Diocletian is really, really scrambling for stability here. You understand what he's trying to do, but again, going back to the good guy, bad guy question, I kind of, because they don't work, I want to say bad, but again, he is doing the best he can with almost no precedent for this,
right.
Which again is just going to further feed into the creation of a new and radically different, much more, again, kind of orientalist potentate kind of empire.
Well, and he really clears the ground for Constantine to succeed where he had failed.
Yes.
Right?
So yeah.
Even economically, and we'll get to this when we get to Constantine. I mean, Constantine is important for what he did religiously.
Right.
In some ways, he's more important for what he did economically.
Yeah.
And again, that's I don't think we'll get to Constantine today.
Oh no.
So having put at least the beginnings of his reforms in place, Diocletian names his Caesar, Maximian names his Caesar, and they all rule happily ever after the end. Not really. I mean, it's sort of true for two of them. So Diocletian names as his Caesar his son-in-law, a guy named Galerius, puts him in charge in the east. Maximian names his son-in-law, Constantius, as Caesar, and puts him in charge of Britain, I believe. Mm-hmm. So we have our tetrarchy, and then to really enforce this, Diocletian takes Maximian's son, Maxentius, so again, sorry, listeners, the Maxes pile up, and Constantius' son, Constantine. Diocletian takes these two to personally train them, which is a generous way of saying he takes them as hostages for good behavior.
Right.
But brings them into the imperial household and begins teaching them how to be emperors, so that when he and Maximian are done being Augustus, the Caesars will rise to the office of Augustus, and two replacement Caesars are waiting in the wings. It takes like a decade, and battle after battle has to be fought with barbarian invaders and with officials in the empire who think they're still in the middle of the third century crisis. And all you need to be an emperor is just to want it. But finally, Diocletian has the chance to do something interesting. He resigns. I think, and Jordan, correct me if I'm wrong on this, I think that the last person we saw resign was Sulla.
That sounds right. Yeah,
I mean, I guess Tiberius sort of disappears off to his island once in a while.
Yeah, but he's still in charge, and people still go to him for decisions. Man. Yeah, I think you're right.
So it's been almost four centuries since someone voluntarily gave up power.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I think you're right.
I think that's fascinating.
Yes.
There are, of course, all sorts of rumors, right? Maybe he was sick. Maybe he was forced to quit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Eusebius said he went mad because of an illness and decided to quit after he recovered, but
right.
Who knows?
Yeah, Eusebius isn't the most unbiased source.
No.
He resigns. Interestingly, he resigns knowing that there's a serious flaw in the tetrarchy. So if we think of that list of Augustine and Caesars that we saw, right? So there's Diocletian as Augustus, Maximian as Augustus, Constantius and Galerius as Caesars. The son of Maximian and the son of Constantius are both taken and basically declared that they're going to be the next Caesar. That leaves Galerius out, right? So his progeny is not part of the succession. Well, the day that Diocletian retires... Maximian retires as well, probably forced to by Diocletian. Galerius shows up, rightly declares himself to be Augustus along with Constantius, so that part of it works, and then puts in as Caesars his own nephew and a friend of his. So Constantine and Maxentius, who were supposed to be the next Caesars, they're both kicked out. maybe Constantius isn't Augustus, but he's not going to live forever. And once he dies, you know, Galerius is going to control the whole thing and the line of succession. The line of succession. Constantine, there's a story that he escapes from the court and flees to where his father's living in England. Arrives in England right as his father dies. Maxentius is absolutely furious about being cut out, pulls his father out of retirement, and usurps the Caesar that Galerius had created. Maxentius takes control of northern Italy and declares himself to be Augustus. So now instead of four high-level officials, we have five. I believe three Augusti and two Caesars. Constantius dies, and the legions in England declare Constantine to be Augustus at York. Constantine sends a very nice note to Galerius saying, look, I'm sorry this happened, what can you do? If I said no, they were going to kill me. I'm an emperor now. I'm an Augustus now. Galerius burned the note and the messenger, but he seemed to realize that there's nothing he can really do about it. If all of this isn't confusing enough, to solve this problem of, you know, now three Augusti in the empire. Aglarius calls an imperial conference, pulls Diocletian out of retirement, declares that he's an Augustus once again. So now there are four Augusti serving in the empire. They get together, decide that yet another Augustus will be chosen. This one, a guy named Licinius. Is that how you say his name?
I think so. It works.
So Licinius will be Augustus in the west. Galerius will be Augustus in the east. Constantine will be Caesar in the west. And Galerius' nephew, whose name I think is also Maxentius, but don't hold me to that, will stay Caesar in the east. Everyone else has to retire or be considered a usurper. Constantine doesn't say anything in response to this. Like, he doesn't say, yes, I accept it. He doesn't say no. But he does keep the title of Augustus. So he sort of tacitly not going along with it. Galerius' nephew gets too big for his britches, declares that he's not content being a Caesar, and that he is now an Augustus as well. So now there are six Augusti ruling in the Roman world, and no Caesars. So, again, the Tetrarchy fails,
yeah.
Right? The big point here is that this this plan to fix the empire, to solve the problem of succession that has always haunted Roman emperors, just does not work. It basically takes the deaths of everyone involved and most of their families for this to work out. So Galerius dies of a particularly horrible bowel cancer that Eusebius takes great delight in describing in detail. So if you want to read an ancient description of someone dying of bowel cancer, it's in Eusebius.
Yeah, go for it.
Licinius moves east, takes care of Galerius' nephew. Constantine defeats Maxentius and his father at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, which we'll get to next time. Constantine and Licinius divide the empire between them, but even that doesn't last. And in 324 AD, the final civil war erupts, ending in Constantine being emperor of the whole Roman world. excuse me. Anything to add in there? That's not quite as complicated as the Roman civil wars, but it's pretty close.
Yeah, and it's frustrating because the where we can reconstruct almost day to day what's going on in the Roman civil wars of the you know, late Republic, our sources for this stuff are so scanty and obviously biased in many cases, like talking about Eusebius, for instance, and. You know, we're relying really heavily as well on things like coins and, you know, various decrees and inscriptions and stuff. I mean, there are chunks of it we just kind of have to piece together. There's a lot going on and it's very dramatic, but we don't have quite the understanding that we would like. I think that's about all we got to say for it, really, until we get to Constantine himself.
Can you talk a little bit about sources? Because I know there's Eusebius and coins and inscriptions, which I think are just amazingly dull to try to study.
I've tried to get myself...
Do we have anything else?
I've tried to get myself into numismatics, and I just can't. There are written literary sources. The thing is, brushing up on this again, one of the books, the author of one of the books I was looking at, you know, points out that... the quantity of literary Latin produced beginning with the reign of Diocletian and running through to the end of like the 4th and 5th centuries is actually greater even than the age of like Caesar and Cicero. But the vast majority of the people doing the writing are churchmen. And a lot of the writing is going to be, you know, theological and doctrinal and involved in, you know, heretical controversies and things like that. So what we've got for politics and the military and the kinds of things that, you know, that Cicero-Caesar era was more concerned with are more limited in quantity. And some of them only survive partially. So a big source, for instance, for post-Constantine is Ammianus Marcellinus. He wrote a history of Rome from the death of Nerva in the first century down to his own lifetime and the death of Julian the Apostate. And I think a little bit thereafter. All that survives is the last couple of books of his history. So we know he wrote about all this, but we don't have it.
And it is awesome, by the way.
Ammianus Marcellinus.
You haven't read it, it's fantastic.
Yeah, he's a real shining star in the historiography of the late empire, where so much of it is, you know, shoddy and of poor literary quality and of questionable historical value. I mean, he's like... you know, he's a Thucydides right smack dab in the middle of all this chaos. So you've got guys.
I hate to spoil this for a future episode, but his description of the rebuilding of the temple under Julian in Jerusalem is, I mean, that story is amazing.
I gotta refresh myself on that.
Fireballs come out of the ground and consume the workers.
Awesome. Yeah. It's been forever, man. So we've got Ammianus Marcellinus, but we've lost his account of the reign of Diocletian. So that's kind of frustrating. Again, some of the things like Diocletian's like price fixing schemes and things like that. We have, you know, maybe one or two copies of it on a papyrus, you know. So sometimes even like the date things happened and the context in which they happened are still kind of closed to us. Then we've got other writers I believe Zosimus covers some of the reign of Diocletian.
Which he's writing in like the 500s,
right?
Right?
So he's definitely right. You get later people working from contemporary material that we don't have anymore. It's comparatively rich, having come out of that 70 years of imperial anarchy where we don't even know all of the guys who claim to be emperor at various points. But it is still problematic and frustrating. It's an interesting historiographical problem to tackle. But as we come out of Diocletian and get toward Constantine, I mean, Constantine is so controversial even in his own lifetime. We're going to get just oodles of material, but there the bias is going to be so strong it makes it very hard to interpret what he's up to at any given time.
Yeah, even in the modern world, there's no such thing as a neutral source on Constantine.
No, absolutely not.
Well, that's probably a good point to, I guess, to ask for. Oh, I was going to do this last. Reading recommendations. We'll do relevance last. What should people read?
To brush up on this because it's been a while. We were talking before we recorded. I just covered Constantine and Diocletian in my Western Civ class 2 days ago, so this was kind of fresh for me. To brush up on that, I revisited again. It's been a while since I've recommended it, so I'll recommend it again. The End of Rome by Adrian Goldsworthy. Goldsworthy's a favorite of mine. You've heard me mention him a zillion times. He's got a very good measured survey of the last couple centuries of the empire. I would also recommend The Later Roman Empire by an author named Avril Cameron, which is a good succinct book. I think it's, let me see it, including further reading in the index. It's like 230 pages. It's part of a series from Harvard UP of classical surveys. And then there's The Fall of the Roman Empire by Michael Grant, which I think is out of print, but you can get like in the kind of bargain area of Barnes and Noble if you're lucky, under Barnes and Noble's own masthead. I'll leave it to those three. Those are three that I consulted to brush up for today, and three that I've read in the past that are really good.
Yeah, and I'll throw in, you've mentioned Eusebius.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Which,
yeah.
Course, is a primary source. Right. There's a, like you said, we don't have much, certainly we don't have much in Latin coming out of this time. So I think whoever you are referencing is right, that this is the beginning of a new golden age in ancient literature. From what I understand, at this point, it's still largely being written in Greek.
A lot, yeah.
So the Cappadocian Fathers, Athanasius, I think, is writing in Greek. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
The one sort of major exception to that I'm aware of off the top of my head is Lactantius.
Mm-hmm.
Lactantius is not a historian. He writes a book called the Divine Institutes, which is Cicero fan fiction, I suppose, for lack of a better way to put it. He basically takes Cicero's books and reworks them in a Christian image. And along the way, we get commentary on what's going on in the empire at his time. So it's all sort of asides and notes to the reader and so on. But it is interesting and it is worth picking up. And then secondary sources, a book called Triumph of Empire by Michael Kulikowski. Mm-hmm. I've got a Profiles interview.
Yeah, that was really good.
It's excellent. He does that hard work of reading coins and inscriptions, and then makes it interesting. Not the reading of them, but he takes the information from them. and writes an interesting. There will be a follow up volume to that if it's not already out.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
I'm sure there's. I didn't look up to see who the author of it was, but there's a series of biographies on the major Roman empires. They all have sort of a black stripe on the cover. So there's Hadrian and Nero and Tiberius and so on. I'm sure there's one in that series on Diocletian. Yeah. I'll look it up and see who the author is and make sure we get that in the show notes.
Good deal.
All right, so what should have been the second to last question, Jordan, how is all of this stuff relevant for today? Why should modern Americans or modern Christians care about Diocletian?
Well, first of all, I mean, to go back to where we kind of started the conversation, it's worth considering what actual persecution looks like. You know, it's as ugly as that New Yorker piece about Chick-fil-A was. That's not persecution, okay?
That was so glorious. Oh, that's, like, talk about your bias just on naked.
Oh, I know, display. I know. I brought it up, but don't get me started. That is not persecution, right? That is you know, maybe blowback. That's, you know, to use a buzzword now, getting bullied. It's, you know, your ideas, your beliefs are unpopular, but it is not actual persecution. And what's the right word to look for here? The kind of mass apostasy of many Christians during the great persecution of Diocletian. And we've got tons of evidence of that. I know as a kid, the emphasis was always on the martyrs, but they're a minority. And we've got tons of those certificates from the ancient world. That's a primary source. Tons of those certificates stating that so-and-so is accused of being a Christian, but he has made the proper sacrifices and, you know, signed local governor, you know, Maximus Joe, whatever. Sounds like a Mad Max character. We've got tons of those certificates. And so it's, you know, worth considering in a country that we've had the run of for a very long time, whether it was, you know, quote-unquote founded as a Christian nation or not. And when, you know, you can unpack every word of that, you don't found a nation, but that's beside the point. In a country where Christians have basically had the run of the country for a very long time and have gotten very complacent, and discouragingly eager to sacrifice their principles for political expediency, and have identified themselves so closely with the country. Right. It is worth considering what happens to a church that has gone that direction when things turn and when things get, like, genuinely ugly. So, I mean, I don't want to get on a soapbox, but I mean, you hear about the experiences of Christians from places like, you know, China visiting the United States. And, you know, it's just such a shock to them what Christian culture is like here as opposed to in a place where, even if they're tolerated, they're constantly in danger. It is simply worth kind of taking to heart and considering and sort of reprioritizing, which I've been doing myself the last several years. Politically, I put this in the show notes, that, you know, it's been kicked around for a while, but apparently it has actually been approved to be in some kind of vote or referendum this fall. Proposals to divide California three ways, and I've even seen those. You know, of course, secession pops up every once in a while, but unfortunately, nobody treats that very seriously. The idea, though, after the Trump election, that California could secede, or now they're even talking about there are proponents of splitting California in three. The reasons they cite look very much like the reasons that a Diocletian would have cited for further divvying up the empire. It's a big state. It's got very diverse population, lots of differing levels of income. I mean, you take like a Sacramento raisin farmer and a Palo Alto, you know, data CEO, and then, you know, average, you know, an immigrant family, you know, working in Los Angeles. The state is having a very hard time balancing the interests of all of those groups and many, many others. So splitting it three ways is a way to kind of alleviate a lot of the pressures that come with a large, very populous and very wealthy political region. It's a story that I only really became. I mean, I've heard these plans before, but you know, I read up a little bit about it yesterday as it kind of hit the headlines as having qualified for a vote. It's a really, really interesting concept. And the first thing I thought of was Diocletian's split of the empire. I was curious to get your idea about that, especially since you added your all caps commentary in our show notes.
Right.
Why
have we not done this already?
Yeah. Yeah, so what would you have to say about relevance? I've gone on long enough.
Yeah, so I would say that obviously a lot of the stuff you said about Christians and persecution, yeah, absolutely, certainly solid. But I also think there's something worth looking at in that so many of Diocletian's reforms don't work, and that might actually be a point of difference between what Diocletian's doing and what. What's going on in California? This is a petition coming from the people of the state of California.
Yes.
And while I'm about as anti-populist as you can get, if you are going to divide a state, that is the way to do it. Right? It's not Congress stepping in and saying, "Well, Congress can't." Right? It has to. You have to have the permission of the state legislature, according to the Constitution, and the permission of Congress. But I think that's actually a good point of contrast. This isn't the federal government coming in and dividing it up, which again, just doesn't work in Diocletian's example. This would be the equivalent of the province of Gaul saying, "Hey, we're too big. Let's divide ourselves up, and things will be a little bit easier administratively." Which I don't know that we have an example of. If that happened in the ancient Roman world, it was so normal and so boring. We don't have a record of it. You know, it didn't involve huge massacres or anything like that. So. So I think there's something to be said there for only very cautiously making big sweeping national changes, even when it looks like you really have to. Although that's going to be given lie by Constantine in the next episode, because he does make some of these national changes, and they do work. They do fix things. So maybe keep some kind of balance between Diocletian and Constantine.
Yeah.
Having talked about all of this, Jordan, what do you think? Is he a good guy or a bad guy?
If I've got to come down on one side, I will say good with an asterisk or two attached to it. Good in that he at least temporarily halts the just constant civil war, right? I mean, it's, and again, it's like 70 years worth, or more, depending on exactly where you want to start the dating of the crisis. Just bringing that to a stop is an accomplishment by itself. But those asterisks I would want you to take you to a footnote where it points out that, you know, some of his reforms didn't work, some of them had really negative unintended consequences, and of course there's also the issue of his, you know, empire-wide persecution of Christians, which is, you know, depending on how far you want to trust descriptions of the you know, martyrdoms and tortures and things, I mean, it's savage even by Roman standards. So weighing that, I mean, I'm going to tip the scales very lightly toward good, and that has mostly to do with simply stopping a chaotic situation and allowing more good to be done maybe later by somebody else. But catch me at another time of day, and I might tip the scale back to bad.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and tip the scale the other way. I think I'll say bad, but only slightly in the bad direction. Mm-hmm. Just because, not just because of persecution, of course. When we're looking at it sort of from the perspective of the option is Diocletian's way of doing things or 50 years of civil war. Okay, fine. Yeah, Diocletian's way of doing things is maybe better, but what, as we've sort of talked about, what Diocletian's way of doing things ends up being is this absolute monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so the Republic has certainly been dead for, you know, four centuries or whatever at this point. It's not coming back. But prior to Diocletian, the emperor is still tied to some kind of deliberative process. Right, there are other government officials. The Senate is still sort of hanging around. The military is still a powerful influence over who the emperor is. So maybe the deliberative process is, you know, combat between legions, but it's still something that's a power beside the emperor. After Diocletian, I mean, it's the emperor all the way down.
Right.
And I am an enemy of absolutism. Yes. And Leviathan.
Yeah.
Much to Ed's regular chagrin. I shouldn't say that when he's not here to defend himself. So I'm somewhat hesitant about that. Even as Constantine will do this slightly differently. Constantine will, quote unquote, baptize a power that will be sort of rival to his own in the church. Diocletian has no view of anything like that other than another emperor, right? Other than the other Augustus. So, yeah, I grant the good of order. I grant the good of no more civil war and, theoretically. No more civil war, despite the continued civil war. Although all of the infighting between, Maxentius and Galerius and so on, that's all sort of pre-third century crisis style civil war, right? It's the sort of thing we would have seen in the first century, the year of the four emperors or whatever. It's where you have basically the only people affected are the generals, right? This isn't spilling over into the Roman population. So it is a civil war, but it's not crisis of the third century style civil war where there's division of the empire and so on. So I'm going to say slightly bad, but only slightly.
Yeah, and again, I could have gone either way. I just decided to come down on the one that surprised me, I guess, as I was talking about it.
Sure. Well, with that, we should close out this episode. The City of Man, Jordan. Thanks for
joining us. Thanks again.
The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in the family. Get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show. You can also like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is the very raspy Coil Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and render unto God those things that are God's.